Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It is Monday, April 11th, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. This week, I sit down with Nick Juhas, the host of Nickipedia on YouTube, and also one of my co-hosts on the Saturday morning Fox Kids show, Fab Lab, where we celebrate science, and we especially focus on what is interesting in the science world to young women. All right, before we dive into my interview with Nick, I want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible this week, especially through the Patreon portal. And remember, you can support the show by visiting patreon.com/talknerdy. All right, this week I want to thank Phil T-Bear and Timothy Glover, who are at the highest level of patronage in the portal. I also want to thank Jaff, the Honorable Husband, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Ken Pfeiffer, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. And of course, I want to thank those of you who are contributing at other amounts as well. It is because of you that Talk Nerdy gets to remain 100% free to download for everybody who's interested in listening. And I do want to do one more little shameless plug before we move on to the show, and that is to invite you to visit my website, carasantamaria.com. There you can see all of the work I do in television, the other work that I do in podcasting, because remember, I also am a co-host on The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, and you can find a link to all of those episodes there as well. And also, you can visit my online store. I just wanted to let you guys know that I have a bunch of new stuff back in stock. We finally have the logo t-shirts in every size available once again. I also upgraded them just a bit. Same price to you, but it's a nicer quality t-shirt. It's kind of thin and really soft, feels a bit vintagey, and has a little bit more of a narrow cut. They look pretty cool. All right, guys, without any further ado, I want to welcome you to sit back, relax, and enjoy this interesting chat. I think that's a good way to put it, that I have with Nick Juhas. Well, Nick, thank you so much for joining me. First ever guest in my new studio.
I'm your first ever guest?
Here in the new house, my first guest.
In the new house.
Yeah, in the new studio.
Okay. Hey, I will take it regardless. That's awesome.
No, you're actually episode like 104. Four, I think.
Okay. And we didn't start at 100, right?
Yeah, we didn't start. Not like TV.
You started at zero.
Yeah, I started at zero. But that's true. TV rules, you always start at 10. And then people think you've been on for years. And you're like, no, that's like season one, episode three is 103.
Right. You just don't tell them that. You're like, no. Yeah, where have you been watching it? It's a very successful series.
Yeah. Speaking of, we co-host together a successful series.
Yes, we do.
Yeah. It's called Fab Lab. It's on Saturday mornings on your local Fox affiliate. And how many episodes in are we?
We are technically we just finished 109. That was in New York City.
We finished filming 109. Do you know how many we've aired yet? Maybe
we've aired five? Seven.
Seven already.
No, six.
Six. Somewhere in between five and seven.
Somewhere in between there.
And have you been in every episode?
I am the only, you're the only one who has been in every episode. Me and Derby the dog.
Oh my God. It's so funny too, because this is a show that is, you know, for tweens, right? That's kind of our target.
Maybe definitely.
I would say 9 to 14. That's usually the range that I mention.
Yeah, and it's definitely focused for the female viewer.
It's for girls. Yeah, it's a show for girls. So it's funny 100%. That Nick is the only co-host whose schedule has allowed him to make every episode.
But I have theories behind this, okay? Here's my one theory, is that in Southern California, all of the science guys are 40 plus.
Oh, that's true. There aren't that many.
Yeah. I mean, I can think of a couple YouTubers, you know, like Derek from Veritasium. There's a couple other YouTubers that are younger, but they're not in LA.
Yeah. A lot of science YouTubers, like if you think about it, Henry Reichman at Physics doesn't live here. Vsauce doesn't live here.
Vsauce 3 that was I was thinking about.
Jake, Vsauce 3 is here. Okay.
He's not here though.
Oh, he's not here. And Derek, of course, is out here, but he's always traveling. He's been on the show before. And I have a few other science friends, Phil Torres, Jason Goldman, they're out here. But you have the special distinction of looking like you're in your early 20s.
I am. I just turned 21.
Sure. And that's the funny thing about our show is that because it's for very, very young girls, of course, it's important to them that there be like a youth vibe to it. Right. And I am not about to claim that I look like I'm in my early 20s.
You do look very young.
I hope so.
Yes, you do.
I mean,
yes.
I would assume that that's kind of necessary for the booking. Carrie looks very young, and she's about our age. Mm-hmm. Asia looks very young. She's about our age. Maddie, of course, is really young.
Yeah. Ironically, speaks like way smarter and more intelligent. Like, she speaks at a level that is let me think about this. How can I say this? Like, at the intelligence of someone who should be my age, right? If they were studying towards a PhD, and I feel like I come with like bro speak. I'm like, yeah, that's totally awesome.
You have a very Southern California way of speech, but you weren't born here.
No.
It's so funny.
Okay. This has been with me my entire life, and I'll tell you where the influence came from. I was a professional stunt rollerblader at the age of 19. But so trends get to Ohio really late.
Yeah.
And so when I was 9, 10, 11 years old, that's when this industry was like blowing up and it was this big, huge thing and it was really cool. And so all of the skate videos are all being filmed in Southern California. So it's like every rollerblader's dream to one day move to Southern California.
Yeah.
And that became our life, our culture, our little group within Hilliard, Ohio. And so that we all had this like pseudo bro California talk as these kids in the Midwest. Yeah, and that's how that whole thing started.
Yeah, you definitely sound like you surf.
I know.
Do you surf?
So I can surf.
Oh, cool.
I learned in Waikiki, which is actually the easiest place to learn how to surf ever.
Is it? Good to know.
It has like the longest break, right? Mm. Because of the way that the volcano, you know, shaped the island, there's this super long field that allows the wave to like basically keep the same consistency across this entire like beachfront area.
Also, it's warm. It's actually
super
warm. Unlike here where the Pacific Ocean is freezing cold.
Yeah.
So surfers have to surf in like wetsuits here.
Right.
Whereas
three-quarter inch.
Yeah, in Hawaii you can wear like board shorts.
Yeah. And just because I'm from the Midwest, right? Everyone's like, oh dude, you're probably used to this, right? I'm like, no. No. Just because like I was born in a cold area
doesn't mean you swim in a cold ocean every day.
Like take cold showers, like sleep outside. Like, what is this? No, like that's not what people from Ohio do. In fact, because I'm so used to like the changing of the weather, I am more prone to being cold. So like that's actually why I don't surf here, because it's weird to do it with booties and I can't stand being cold in the water.
It's really cold in the ocean here. People think that, I mean, the beaches are beautiful, the ocean is beautiful, but it's really cold. Like you don't get in the water really unless it's like the heat of summer and you want to kind of cool off.
The other thing is that a lot of people from the Midwest, they go to east of the Mississippi, right? So they go to Florida, the
Carolinas.
Where
the water is nice and warm.
Yeah. So like all I ever knew as a kid growing up is like, oh, here's the ocean.
Yeah.
It's bath water. This is amazing. Yeah. Come out to California. I'm like, what is this? Someone playing a joke? This is ridiculous.
It is. It's crazy. It's very cold. But it's funny that you adapted sort of the speech of the kids that you were watching in videos. I think that that's probably not uncommon for like skater kids coming up who were watching all of those videos, for kids like you who rollerbladed. I had two really good friends who were semi-pro rollerbladers in high school. So like super random.
Do you remember their name? It's a really small community.
Yeah. So my friend Jenny Paul but she's a girl. So there might not have been as much crossover.
Did she ever go by like JP or something like that? Or
no, I think she was always Jenny Paul.
Okay.
Jenny P. Little Jenny.
Jenny P, okay.
Little girl. Oh, and she had a friend named Carrie, but I don't remember Carrie's name. And then there was a boy. Oh, I'm going to blank on his name. He was really good because, so when I was young, I used to train at a gymnastics facility, but I totally sucked.
Oh.
It was like a world-renowned gymnastics facility where Olympians train.
Was it?
WOGA, World Olympic Gymnastic Academy, in Plano, Texas. I was terrible. Like I had no business being there, but there was this one boy who was in my grade in high school and he was a phenomenal gymnast who then took up rollerblading. So he his like tricks were insane.
There is definitely a correlation between being a great gymnast, and it's what it really comes down to is knowing where you are in space and time.
Mm-hmm.
And so like having full body control, rollerblading is a lot like figure skating in many ways, but then it's kind of like you sort of, you know, smash that up against with BMX, not skateboarding, actually, ironically enough, more of BMX than skateboarding.
Oh, interesting.
Skateboarding is actually more about what the board does, and BMX is somewhat about what the bike does, but it's really what the body does. And that's actually how rollerblading is. It's not about really what your feet do or what the rollerblades do. It's about what your body does, right? So like a trick is like you did a 540, a 720, a bio, or like a corkscrew. It's really about how the body is moving in motion. So that tends to like create a whole different type of learning curve for like how your brain would understand, like, you know, oh, I'm flipping the board and it's doing this and I'm grinding like that, like a kickflip or whatever it may be.
So much of it is your feet.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's like the core of your body, like knowing where your center of gravity is.
Yeah.
Because you can't do, you know, a 540 over a 20-foot kicker and just think that your feet are magically going to like, oh yeah, this is where you're going to land. Like you have to know.
Shabra. Toads McGoat.
Ted's going up for 270 more for Royale, you know?
You should talk to my boyfriend. Like you, I mean, you met when you came in, but like you should talk to him more because he, when he was a kid, like a young kid, was a stunt BMXer.
And
actually did a Gatorade commercial. Nice. When he was like a little boy, like
doing
stunt stuff on his bike. And I think it like helped him pay for college.
That's impressive. Putting it to good. You know, the only thing I got were medical bills, extensive medical bills.
Did you get paid when you were doing that? Or was it more like a thing you do for fun? It seems like in order to get paid, you have to transition into like a full-time kind of a thing.
Yeah, the industry is really small, right? And at one point in time, at the peak of the rollerblading industry, it was like in the 90s, there was one skater by the name of Aaron Feinberg, and he got paid by Salomon, which is actually a ski company. They make ski boots and bindings and whatnot. And they got into the extreme world of sports through rollerblading. They actually use a lot of their same technology for like their insoles and whatnot, and like the boots. And he made $1 million. That was his contract, right? And so that was like
the most insane thing ever.
Mind blowing. The kid was like 15 and he was doing backflips. And I mean, it was just like he was
just fucking around on skates.
He was murdering it.
He's
though.
Like, but like, he's just for fun. Like, he's like, I'm fucking around on skates. I'm getting really good. And then these people are like, if you wear our skates, we'll pay you $1 million.
Yeah. And I can't speak for Aaron Feinberg, but I know that he wasn't a Wall Street investor.
Yeah.
And I don't know where all that money went, but I do know that he stayed in the industry kind of like, you know, he came in and out. Mm-hmm. And then towards the end, I believe he had another pro skate. It was with USD and Universal Skate Design or Upside Down. It's a European brand, which is now an American brand. And he just was like back in the game, but it didn't appear as if, you know, he didn't roll in on a Bentley.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Yeah. It's probably the money in that sport, just because it didn't take off the way that like skateboarding did, is probably very different. So, and even then, I know people who skateboarded who were semi-pro, who were like pro for a little, or who were like really good in amateur leagues, who you got to be the best of the best.
If there ever needs to be a doc that needs to be made, it should be about this particular thing. It's so interesting. The birth, the peak and the decline of the rollerblading industry, because it's such like a black sheep sport anyways. Like of the black sheep sports, it's the black sheep sport.
That's true. I mean, did you get made fun of by skateboarders?
It was so weird. When I was in the Midwest, it was the coolest thing anyone had ever seen.
Yeah.
As soon as I left the Midwest, it was like laughingstock of the skate park. And I was so confused because I grew up with that being like the alternative culture cool thing. And skateboarding was that's what my like dad does.
That's so weird. Because definitely my rollerblade friend, Jenny, used to talk about how, they would like make fun of the rollerbladers, like all the skaters like owned the skate park, and then the rollerbladers were kind of like
the black sheep.
They were the black sheep of the skate park, and they had to like fight to get time on the ramp. But it was
like a turf war.
Yeah, it was a turf war, but it was also really hard and really impressive when you saw them doing well.
The difference is like, okay, snowboarding and skiing, right? On a snowboard, because I'm a snowboarder, right? I love snowboarding. No matter what you do on a snowboard other than falling, looks pretty cool, right? Yeah. Like it looks like you got something going for you, even if you're just carving, right? Skiing is innately easier, right? You can just go down the mountain and you can like snowplow and like you can get it done without dying, right?
Yeah.
But then to make it look cool
is really hard.
Yeah. And so rollerblading sort of suffers from that same problem, which is like you throw on a pair of rollerblades, you look ridiculous. But then to make it look flawless and amazing is super duper hard.
That's funny. And probably on the water, it's the same thing because water skiing is like douchey.
Right.
It's like, oh, he's a professional water skier, but yeah. like wakeboarding is badass.
Exactly. Yeah. And like, I think a lot of it has to do too with like, just how the sport lends itself to hanging out and culture, right? Mm-hmm. Skateboarding, you can grab a skateboard and go to the skate park. If you do one lap around and, you know, NBD, like you're still at the skate park, you still did some stuff. If you're in rollerblades and you're just sitting there, yeah. it looks kind of weird, right?
Yeah.
Like you really do have to be like active on skates. And like it's kind of uncomfortable depending on the skates. So like you have to be, you know, it's kind of like you're getting the business done and you're out, right? Like I never skated for more than like an hour max at a park. You're done. You know what I mean? Like when I was a little kid, we would spend like 8 hours there, you know, like drinking Red Bulls and yeah. Gatorade, like nonstop, like around the clock. But yeah. So anyways, the documentary that needs to be made about the rollerblade industry is the moment in time that it started going downhill. And it can all be traced back to Arlo Eisenberg being in this executive boardroom meeting with all the other X Games like heads, basically,
uh-huh.
and knowing that the skateboarding industry is losing dollars, right?
Yeah.
Constantly losing dollars, just like how like the Razor scooter made rollerblading lose dollars because it was the new fad. They were thinking, how can we, you know, get this industry lower than it is, right?
Okay.
Well, Arlo Eisenberg didn't help at all when he came in there raging and like didn't negotiate at all for like where rollerblading was supposed to be in the time frame of the X Games,
uh-huh.
which then led to the X Games being totally free of rollerblading. No more.
So and you think that it was Eisenberg that actually... Okay, this is so funny. Because as soon as you said Arlo Eisenberg, I was like, I know that name.
It's
and
the
I Googled
park
it. That's the skate park we used to hang out at in Plano, Texas.
Yeah.
It was Eisenberg Skate Park.
He's like the godfather of rollerblading.
And he's like from my hometown.
No way!
Yeah, he built Eisenberg Skate Park in... His family opened Eisenberg Skate Park in Plano, Texas,
yeah.
where they hosted the skate competition, the Eisenberg Showdown
Which
at the Hoedown.
In. I competed.
You've been to my hometown?
Yeah, I've been to the Showdown at the Hoedown.
That is so weird.
When I went to Australia this last time to do science experiments, uh-huh. the guy that I went on tour with that we went to the Hoedown with was the guy Cade from Australia. We were on the same, like...
That is so weird. Like, because my childhood is shaped by spending time at Eisenberg's. And mm-hmm. even though I wasn't a skater, all of my friends were. And all of my friends' punk rock bands used to play at Eisenberg's. And so for me, that is the epitome of skate park. And it's so crazy that he was the founder of basically this sport. Not the founder, but really popularized
close.
It.
Very, very close.
Yeah.
If you could, like, point a finger anywhere, like... He would be like the when I said like Michael Jordan, right, mm-hmm. of the sport, like founder, like he came up with a lot of the names for the grinds, like
that's
he like had the
so
first
weird.
Grind plate. He has like countless wheels and frames. Like,
and I think that he was my friend Jenny's mentor.
See,
yeah, because like, they were really close to that family.
Yeah.
It all comes together. This is so weird. Anybody who's like, I have no fucking idea what you guys are talking
yeah.
about right now.
Isn't this about science?
I know
or something?
This is a science podcast. That's why I love Talk Nerdy, though. We can talk about whatever the fuck we want.
This is super nerdy.
I know.
This is like
it is
nerdy,
really nerdy
as it gets.
That's true. But you know, so I do want to kind of come back to, because you mentioned just now doing some science work. So you do Fab Lab, but that's not really where you started by any
right.
stretch. The reason that you were booked onto Fab Lab is most likely because of the work that you do on YouTube.
Correct.
And then the work that you do on YouTube has fed a lot of other opportunities. So tell everybody listening what Nikipedia is, how it came up, and like why it is you do it.
Definitely. So it's such a cool story. It really is. Like, I love telling this story because, like, the birth of it is such an interesting, like, organic story and how it all came about.
Mm-hmm.
So there's actually, it's kind of like two streams sort of like meshing into one in perfect timing. Before I did anything in the science world, any of that, like, how it all started is I was a pre-med student in school, right? And I loved biology.
In Ohio.
Okay. My freshman year, so I was a wrestler, actually, mm-hmm. And I was going to wrestle in college and then be a pre-med student. But then wrestling is like really tough in college. It's like a full-time devotion kind of thing. And like, I just wanted a break. Like,
yeah.
I had a really intense wrestling high school experience. And so it was my life. I was like one of those kids.
Yeah.
And so it was really good while I was doing it, but I really wanted a break. I wanted the college experience. So I chose pre-med, of course, right? Like, what was I thinking?
Quintessentially collegiate of you.
Right. My freshman year, though, I was really hell-bent on this rollerblading thing to bring back that around. And so I moved to California when I was 19 to become a professional stunt rollerblader, still, though, studying biology.
Gotcha.
And so what I did, because I was so focused on rollerblading, I spread out my biology degree, like, really wide, like, thin over the course of 5 years.
So where did you... So you had started in Ohio, and then did you transfer to a school out here?
I did. So I started at Miami of Ohio my freshman year. Traditional college experience, Miami, like... It's very much like a Midwest school, like, you know, you live in the dorms, the whole thing. You know what I mean, it was go to the gym, like got almost rushed to fraternity, like did all that. Then when I moved out, it was kind of like a whole different experience. But what prefaced this experience is that for 79 days prior to that, I traveled with my dad around the world, completely around the world. And not like, oh, we're going to like go on a cruise. It was like backpacking, like get in it type of travel adventure.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, my dad's super rad. And so
it sounds like it.
Which is actually, my dad will tie back into the story.
Nice.
And so I felt like I had this like total like visa to go anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. And I was like, just not going to settle for Oxford, Ohio. Right.
Yeah.
It was like farther away from a big city than where I grew up. Right. Like I grew up like in a suburb. So I was like, had that craving to like get in it and like get in the city and experience new stuff.
Yeah.
I just saw the whole world. You know, was I going to come back and like chill in a cornfield? Like,
it is funny how that perspective can really change things. Like if you've never left, the world feels really big where you are. And the minute you leave and you come back, it feels very small.
So small. Yeah. And even smaller being in this like college town.
Yeah.
So I actually remember the phone call very distinctly. I called my mom and it was like, I just gone to a party. I probably had a few drinks. I remember like, and I was rollerblading actually. I was in Indiana and we were skating. And I remember saying, I'm thinking about going to school somewhere else. And my mom's from Indiana, right? So she grew up in this little tiny place called Elkhart. And she's like, yeah, I understand. I went from Ball State to IU, which is like, it's like 45 minutes, you know what I mean? And I was like, yeah, like I'm thinking like further than like that. She's like, well, you can always go to Ohio State. We don't mind. And I was like, that's like 15 minutes away from my house.
No.
And I was like, yeah, no, I mean like further. And she's like, oh, like, where are you thinking? And I was like, in my mind, had already had it mapped out. I had like a business plan, like ready to rock and roll. And I was going to San Diego. Like,
yeah.
I had my like heart set on San Diego because San Diego is where the rollerblading industry is, right? Like every major sponsor, like the whole shebang is in San Diego, the birthplace.
And it has like some of the best schools in the country. I mean, SDSU and UCSD are incredible schools and they have great medicine.
So as a bio major, I did my homework and I found out that UCSD was a better biology school. Now, being an Ohio resident, I wouldn't have residency until another year and a half, something like that. So I transferred to this smaller school called San Diego Mesa College, which is a community college, right? And so I moved out there. I was like out on my own for the first time. But like when you move from Ohio to California, it's not like going to college one state away. It's like you might as well be on the moon, right? Because you're literally a day away from rescue help from any parental figure. I mean, there's no like...
You're on your own.
Yeah, you're 33 hours by car away.
Yeah,
you're 5 hours by flight. You're on your own, dude. Yeah. And so, I mean, I felt like I could handle it because I just did this whole experience around the world kind of thing. And so
But it also sounds like you had a really close family. So
I did.
It was a big deal for you to leave home.
It was because, you know, born, raised, same house, same school, same friends, the whole thing, right? So first real like immersive experience out of Ohio. And like in my mind, I thought San Diego was going to be just like Columbus, Ohio, but better weather.
Yeah.
Like, no. Like,
but the weather was better.
The weather was way better. Yeah.
San Diego has the best weather.
Best.
Oh my God.
So while I was there, I learned, that's where I took all my physics courses, my math, my calculus classes. And I actually got really, really, really lucky because San Diego Mesa College actually has one of the best records for math and physics.
Nice.
Like, because they're a feeder for UCSD.
Yeah.
And so while I was there, I actually turned pro, right? So I was like really focused on rollerblading. And then I had to at some point say, where am I actually going to go to college?
Mm-hmm.
Is it going to be UCSD or somewhere else? The problem is that in that time frame that I was there, so many people moved to San Diego that their residency rules had changed from underneath me.
That sucks.
And so I was like,
you're like, I'm almost there. And then they're like, no, you got to stay another year.
It was pretty intense. They were like, well, you could pay $26,000 a year, or you could, like, you know, go the extra year and a half. And I was thinking, what more classes am I going to take at this school? Like, I'm going to end up going to this community college for three quarters of, like, what I should be going to school.
Yeah.
You know? So I was like,
that's hard too.
That's
and
tough.
I mean, I remember when I applied to PhD programs from Texas, and I applied to a few in California because I was like, oh, I don't know where I want to go, but California seems nice. I ultimately went to New York, but just the common application for these schools, it's like they must ask you 10 times. Do you live in California? How long have you lived in California? Yeah. Basically, don't even bother if you don't live in California.
Right.
You're like, I don't think I have a shot here.
Yeah.
And even if you do get in from out of state, it's brutally expensive.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're very selective. Yeah.
And my parents actually said, we will do it. We will, like, take a loan. We'll, you know, like, mortgage the house, whatever. And
insane.
I was like, let's pump the brakes, all right? So I talked to my team manager, Richie Velasquez, and I said, hey, look, dude, is it possible for me to, like, represent the Midwest section as opposed to the California section for my team sponsorship? And he said, yeah, that's not a problem. Look, I mean, like, we can fly you for the major sponsor, like, the major competitions, and Chicago, like, that's a stone's throw away. Like, you can do a lot in the Midwest. I thought, this is the last thing in the world I wanted to do was go back to the Midwest. But I thought, how on earth can I just, like, get in, get out, move on, come back to San Diego?
And not be crushed in debt and put your parents in debt for, like, they'd still be paying off your college.
100%. Yeah. And truth be told, I was also very much missing the community sense of college. Mm-hmm. I was craving it, and I never really got it.
Because you were at a commuter school, basically.
Right.
People, usually when people go to community college, it's either because they have another job and they're already, they have a life, they have a family, they're not interested in, like, broing it up with people at school.
No. Yeah.
Or they've just gotten out of high school and they're trying to figure out their way. But there's definitely not, like, fraternity, you don't get that kind of college experience.
And in San Diego, there's a lot of military. So a lot of them are older, they're established, they're married, they've, like, they're basically, like, working off of that money that the government from the military experience is giving them. So, like, they're, like, in on a mish. They're not trying to be like, yeah, let's get margaritas on the weekend.
That's, like, definitely, like, the way I was in college, which is funny because even at a four-year school, I did do a community college first, though. Like, I had a very similar path to you.
Nice.
But even when I was at the four-year school, it was like, research, go home, don't be a college student. Like, I was very anti, but I saw it. It was all around me.
Yeah.
I didn't smoke a lot of weed back then. That's kind of a college student thing to do.
That's very college. Sit on the couch. It's been there for, like, 10 years.
That's true.
It's like being grandfathered to, like, every resident.
It's like the one that's, like, sit. There's always, like, a couch on the porch.
Right. Yes. Which they actually outlawed at Ohio State because they burned them after every game, after every football game, which then brings me to where I went to school next, Ohio State.
Oh, your mom must have been so happy.
Yes. Every UHAS has gone to Ohio State, and they give you a little number, right, for your email.
Yeah.
And so I'm UHAS.4.
That's adorable.
Because I'm the fourth UHAS to go.
And your name is pretty uncommon. So
very uncommon.
It's only your family that's been there.
That's
hilarious.
My brother was UHAS 3.
Damn him. And then your mom and your dad?
Yeah, both. Because they got their master's in education. So my dad was a high school principal and teacher. And my mom was a teacher as well. She taught English and health to deaf students. So she didn't teach sign language, but she taught with sign language.
Mm-hmm.
So education was, like, very, very much, like, encouraged and focused in my family.
So your mom knows ASL?
Yes.
Oh, that's crazy.
And California, to my understanding, because there's two different ones.
Very cool.
There's California Sign Language, and then there's American Sign Language. Go figure, right?
Yeah, that's
California.
Very weird.
It's like, yeah, dude. Like,
it's like Shabra. It's like a Shabra sign. That's so cool.
Yes.
It's very hard to learn.
Very. Very. So once I got to Ohio State, it was, like, time to hit the books and, like, get in, get out, rock and roll. And in that time period, I had really racked up the injuries in this whole rollerblading process. Like, I had three titanium pins in my ankle. I'd broken my tibia straight through. Both wrists are, like, missing this, like, crucial ligament where your scaphoid is, like, both gone. You know what I mean? Like, and then there was this one period, there's one moment in time, right, that I can remember so distinctly. And I was doing a mirror 360 Royale to alley-oop topsoil 180 out on this down rail.
Yeah.
NBD, yo, right? So, and I was nailing it, but then a couple times, what that means is you spin a full 360 degrees, you land on a rail, and then you switch up your feet, and then you rotate again out of the rail.
Okay.
Going down 15 stairs, right?
Gotcha.
So very technical type thing, years worth of practice to figure this thing out.
Very dangerous too.
Yeah. And so I was wearing a tank top, like, why? I don't know.
Because you were bringing some San Diego back home with you.
Yeah. and what happened is I rotated 270, so I didn't quite make the, you know, full rotation to 360 to land on the rail. And I kind of bailed and went head first. And I wrapped my arms around the rail to like save my face, basically.
Sure.
But in that process, I rail burned my arm, which is actually nothing more than a rug burn. But it was such an extensive patch of my skin that, like, when I was all said and done, like, my arm was like gooing because all the skin was gone. And I was like, oh man, I'm going to let that chill out for a moment. In the chill out phase, I realized that, like, oh, I really need like second skin, like, all over my arm. And once it like scabbed, I couldn't move my arm without it like cracking
and open,
bleeding everywhere. So I was like,
so wait, you didn't go to the doctor, is what you're saying?
I didn't go to the doctor, no. Because, I mean, in the rollerblading like sphere,
sure,
right?
You didn't break anything.
Yeah, I mean, you get injured so often, you're just like, whatever, I know how to first aid myself.
But of course, Mr. Premed should know that that is a massive infection waiting to happen.
Which is why it's scarred, and which is why I still have a scar on my left arm.
Yeah.
But so it was right around like football season, which is huge at Ohio State.
Oh, yeah.
And so I took that time to like rest up, right? That's also right when I started taking organic chemistry, right?
And which you kind of need to focus to pass that class.
Mega focus. Yeah. So I thought, look, if I could maybe like transfer some of this like, you know, energy and effort, I'll rest, I'll focus my energies on my schooling, I'm going to rock and roll on this. It's like now like the edge of the cliff, it's time to jump. I need to be focused. Let's do it. So I told my team manager, hey, look, I'm going to take a break. He said, totally, you know, happened to me when I had my first kid, I took a break, came back. Mm-hmm. I was twice as good, had a different perspective, everything. I was like, great. Like there's a future in this still, I can still do this.
Yeah.
Got super involved in like everything pre-med. Like I was an anatomy TA. I was working on being published as a chemist for organic chemistry. We were doing this whole experiment about fluorous tagging with complex carbohydrates. I was working with D-mannose. And so we were basically creating like sugars that, you know, not necessarily like Splenda, you know, since you're replacing like a chloride with an alcohol group, but what we were doing was we were creating like non-digestible sugars.
Yeah, okay.
Which could potentially, sometimes they taste like sugar, right? But the anomer doesn't. So the anomer is like the mirror image of the sugar.
Gotcha.
And those were basically, we're thinking like biofuels or making like plastics. We didn't know the application, but we were creating them, right?
Yeah, with just this creating new molecular compounds that have some sort of sugar-like tendency.
And it was really about the method. It wasn't necessarily about the end product. It was how we got there. And we were using a 16-part protecting group, right? So like it blocks, you know, where like the alcohol should go, and then it like moves away. And then you basically like create an opening spot, and then you build complex carbohydrates by this method.
Did you do any of this, just as an aside? I had a friend who was much more into chemistry than I was, but he was really into computational chemistry. So he would do a lot of this kind of stuff using modeling software. Mm. Were you doing that, or was it mostly just wet work in the lab?
Wet work in the lab.
Gotcha.
I spent so many hours like creating these like little like tubes and like listening to Britney Spears. I remember that was a big thing. I really liked that.
So it's a lot of pipetting and then a lot of testing afterwards.
Pipetting, yes. Yeah. I loved pipetting, by the way. I was a pipetter master.
Yeah. A lot of students are when they spend a long time in the lab. I definitely was, I had my fair share of wrist pain from pipetting.
Yeah, which makes you think like, if I can do this with glass, what else can I do with glass? Like you start to think like you're like really good at creating things with glass. Like, I don't think it gives you the creative license to do that, but
no,
whatever.
But you do. When you do the same thing every day over and over, I do think you get an inflated sense of confidence.
Yes.
But also, it's funny. People who are listening to this right now, I would venture to guess that there's at least 10 people. That might be a very low number. That might be a high number. That are actually pipetting as they're listening to
us. I hope so. So much.
Because I do get tweets a lot of times from people saying that like they listen to Talk Nerdy while they're in the lab.
If you make them too thin though, then they turn to like hair.
Yes.
And then they get stuck on your clothes.
Yes, you got to get just the right.
Just the right thickness.
That's amazing.
But so I very like waist deep into all the science stuff, right? And then I started thinking like, okay, well now I'm coming up on biochem, like I'm coming up on like, you know, MCAT's next, you know, like I'm almost here. And I really loved biology and I started shadowing some physicians. I shadowed a physician about, he was doing upper appendages, orthopedics, right? I really wanted to get involved in orthopedic surgery.
Don't hate me when I say I would totally peg you for ortho.
Oh,
if
yeah.
You were, yeah. My friend Varshana was on the podcast maybe 10 episodes ago. You guys might remember. And she's doing radiology now. She finished her MD and is doing her first, I guess she's past her internship, or she's finishing her internship and starting her residency. And while she was in town, we were hanging out with all of my Nerd Brigade friends. And we were like, being like, okay, definitely pediatrics, definitely infectious disease, blah, blah, blah. But like, yeah, orthopedics is a very specific breed. It's mostly dudes.
It's total bro dude.
It's so bro-y. It's
like, dude, you broke that. We're going to re-break it, drill it, and you're going to be good.
Yeah, like orthopedics tools are all like hammers.
They are. It's like a bunch of boys. Like yeah, you like gave
drills.
Them. Yes. It's like, it's totally insane.
And a lot of them are like ex-frat boys.
They are.
It's so true.
100%. And they all go to the gym and they like juice and they like, you know, protein shake. Then I'm going to like put this guy's rib back in, you know, order.
And you're like a gym rat too, aren't you?
I am 100%. Yeah. Like I love it. It's so it's a funny. Part of my day, you know?
So you're like orthopedics all the way. Yeah. I want to get in there. I mm-hmm. want to fix people's broken bones.
Yeah. Cause it was around sports. I'd mm-hmm. broken a lot of bones. I know what that was all about.
Yeah, you
know,
you like had pins
broke
in your
my elbow,
feet.
Broke my fingers, broke
ankle?
My
ankle.
Ankle.
Pins?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Titanium.
Titanium.
So I'm like kind of like Wolverine, but like not.
You're totally like what? Yeah.
I'm like at least 0.3% like Wolverine.
You are.
Like my bones and my, you know, one leg are like very reinforced.
Totally cybernetic. Sure.
Whatever. But anyway, so actually in my like internship, right, I actually kind of came to the conclusion that I actually might be more interested in a creative field, not necessarily one that was medicine related. Mm-hmm. I loved biology. I loved sciences. I loved knowing how things work and then applying that to my daily life. But
I love, first of all, that you described that as a creative field because it is so creative.
It is.
And people don't give it that creative
110%.
Due. Yeah. Science is an incredibly creative endeavor. Oh.
How do you think we know what we know?
Exactly.
Right? Like you had to like think about how to test it to get the information.
And like lots of times people don't realize that the tools in the toolkit of the scientist didn't exist before they decided to answer a question. They were like, how do I answer this question? Oh, I need this one thing that'll split this one thing. How do I do that? I guess I need to build a tool for it.
Right.
Like they, in like most of, like PCR is such a good example.
Yeah.
Like revolutionized biology, chemistry, you know, molecular, and forensics, until we had polymerase chain reaction, like everything sucked when you were trying to sequence DNA.
Right.
It was so hard.
No, it's so true.
But that is a tool that a scientist invented
in
an effort to be able to do better science.
Yeah. I think like the microwave, are mm-hmm. you familiar with this story too? It's so interesting.
No.
They're like, so the guy who, he didn't really invent the microwave. Mm-hmm. It was an accident, actually. He was creating
Viagra.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Same kind of deal. He was trying to create a power source for radars.
Oh.
And then he noticed that his chocolate bar kept melting in his pocket because it was being exposed to open microwaves.
That's crazy.
And then they popped popcorn. And they're like, something's going on here.
We shall put it in a box with buttons on the front.
Exactly.
That's
yeah.
Brilliant, actually.
So, I mean, it was a creative, you know, he solved a problem by realizing that something was happening, you know?
Yeah. And no, that's the thing.
Created this like, amazing solution.
And we think about a lot, you know, I hate it when people poo-poo space exploration. Like
right.
when they poo-poo the NASA budget, which is already not what it needs to be. It's half of minimally what it should be.
Right.
And they say like, oh, what good is it just like going to Mars? Like, why do we need to be able to do that? You know,
it's like a trail of inventions.
Exactly. It's people don't realize all of the things that come from doing that heavy lifting and that amount of problem solving. Because to basically do the impossible requires just a level of genius and a level of pushing yourself out of your comfort
right.
zone that we don't often get to do in our everyday lives. There's a very privileged few who get to do that as a career.
The only thing that comes close is having a world war, right? Because it requires people to do all this crazy
it's
stuff.
True. Yeah.
But like that sets you backwards in many ways, mm-hmm. right? So like we don't want another world war. So let's go to Mars instead, right?
Because it's
true. That sounds way better.
But you're right. During wartime, there are a lot of genius things that happen. They just happen under a cloak oftentimes. Whereas when you get to do this kind of development for exploration, for, you know, dreaming big things, you get to do it widely in the public eye, which is really exciting as well. Have you ever done a JPL tour?
You know,
I haven't either, even though I have a million friends that work at JPL.
My girlfriend went to JPL, and she works in like entertainment news.
Yeah. So, and I've been to JPL for jobs. Like I've like gone there to do interviews, but I've never had like the tour. So by now I'm like the last of my friends that is doing it. So I'm sure there would be a couple of people who'd want to go back for another time. But if I finally book a JPL tour, you're coming with me.
I would like, yes, please.
Cool. My friend Holly, she's an optics engineer. She was on the show, Holly Bender, if you guys remember. She sometimes hosts tours, so she can...
That would be so awesome. Okay, I have a really funny like story about JPL.
Okay.
I was just trying to go hiking, actually, and I was following my Google Maps, and it took me up this road, and I was like, oh, this is really cool. And then it stopped, and it's like, government property, do not get out of your car. And I was like, whoa, where did I just end up? And then I saw the sign out front, it was like, NASA. And I was like, no, that's ridiculous. Like, I didn't just stumble upon NASA, did I? And then we were like, oh, it's the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. I was like, oh, this is JPL.
Yeah,
like,
because it's Pasadena.
I just moved and I didn't know where I was like in the geography of the land. I was just trying to go hiking because I moved to Los Feliz when
That's
I first
awesome.
Moved here.
Yeah, so it's really close.
Right next door.
It's right next door. Do you know how happy I am that I'm now closer to all my friends?
Yeah.
So many of my friends live in Pasadena because they either work at JPL or they work at Caltech. And or they went to Caltech. And when I was in Hollywood, it was a bitch to get anywhere. And now that I'm here in Los Feliz, I just texted my friend Tegan, who's also been on the show, by the way, Tegan Wall, if remember. And you've met Tegan because she did an episode of Fab Lab. I texted her and I was like, leave work, come eat lunch with me, like take a long lunch. And she's like, totally there because it's only like a 20-minute drive.
That's awesome.
I'm so happy.
I live on the West Side, which for all the people who don't live in LA, don't understand this, but I'll just try to put this in perspective. It's like living in a whole separate city away. So like when I lived in Columbus, Ohio, and if I ever said someone, I'm going to Cleveland, right? That's 2.5-3 hours, right? Akron's like along the way. With traffic, that's the same thing from going from Pasadena to the west side
really far.
Of LA.
That's
it
really
could
far.
Be 2 hours.
Oh, for sure. It took you 45 minutes to get to me.
At 9 o'clock at night.
Yeah, that's true. We're recording pretty late, and it took you a long time to get here from the west side.
Speaking of driving, right? Like, I'm going to wrap this back around to the first time I ever drove back to Ohio, right? When I did that, I actually came back with all my rollerblading gear, and I put it in my closet, and I never actually reopened it back up after I got injured, right?
Yeah.
But what I forgot to do was take out my sweaty pads.
Ew.
And so when I found them this spring after I was doing this internship that I was telling you guys about, I opened it up, and it like almost killed me. Because the bacteria had been like pluming in this like bag.
That is so disgusting,
it was
Nick.
Rancid, beyond rancid. Because I wore shin guards, which were actually like neoprene, like
So they soaked up all your sweat, all of the bacteria. Like, that's the grossest thing I've ever heard.
I'm sure the cure for every disease ever was like in that microfauna of
but
bacteria.
But also the cause of every disease.
That was it. Yellow fever mixed with like.
So wait, you actually never finished your story. You were saying that you ended up back at Ohio, but you never finished how Nikipedia got started.
Right. So, when I was at Ohio State, and I was like thinking about the sciences, I took the MCAT actually, and I didn't do so hot my first year. I felt it was too rushed.
Really common.
So I was like, all right, well, I'm going to take another, like in my next year, I'm going to take this to double minor and then finish up my one biochem credit. And then I'm going to polish off any of the other sciences that I need to. My GPA was so good. Like, I really focused on it. Like, I'm very proud to say I graduated with a 3.92. Like, I really focused hard on it.
Yeah.
And, but in that super senior year, I was like, all right, well, I'm going to pick, you know, two subjects of interest. And I picked economics, and then I picked acting for film and production. So, like, acting and theater. And it was in this gap, spring in between that summer, because by random chance, I decided that I was going to apply to Yale Summer School, right?
Okay.
Because I thought maybe if I don't go to medical school, I could go to entrepreneurship MBA school, basically.
Gotcha.
And so I was like, well, I'll get a leg up on everybody, and I'll go to their, like, you know, their undergrad for summer school, which the requirements, by the way, are much, like, lower, right? Like, getting into summer school is a lot easier than going in there as, like, an undergrad.
Yeah, so but it gave you an option.
But it gave me an option, right? So backtracking a little bit, that spring in between, this is a true story, this is, like, so random. I was on student government, uh-huh. and I was in the Senate, but in the Senate, I was also part of Budget and Finance Committee. Okay. So I knew where the dollars were being allocated, and they were giving away these things called Alternative Spring Break grants for $500, right? And you basically had to, like, go do something good or educational for your spring break.
So basically, don't go to South Beach and get drunk.
Right. You couldn't, like, study, like, alcohol poisoning, yeah. right? Like, that didn't make the cut.
Yeah.
So I was, like, really, like, trying to think of a crafty way to do this. So my fraternity friend, not brother, because I was in Delta Tau Delta. Then there were, like, Phi Psi's, two totally different fraternities. And, like, this people, like, don't know about, like, the turf war.
I was going to say this is all Greek to me, which I totally did not mean to be funny.
Boom, boom.
But it really, like, the world of frats
yeah.
is so beyond me.
But it's also very turfy, right?
Yeah. Oh,
like,
sure.
You don't just, like, stroll up in, like, another fraternity's house or, like, you're not, like, seen really. Like, there's, like, sort of, like, brother. You can, like, kind of hang out. You're all part of the Greek system, but it's definitely, like, we're the coolest. No, we're the coolest.
That's so funny.
No, we have a track record of being the coolest.
Boys beating on their chest.
Yeah, 110%.
But then sororities are the same way. So.
Yeah. So I wanted this opportunity that he had proposed, which was a leadership academy in Cabo San Lucas, right?
Okay.
To make this story very short, because it's very detailed and very long, I basically wrote myself permission to go and put all of this, like, all this funding, like my plane ticket and everything, on a credit card, hoping that I'd get that money back.
Yeah.
Because I was actually denied from the Leadership Academy by the guy who was, like, running it, but I was too stubborn for him to tell me no. So I figured if I just showed up.
Yeah, what could he do?
Well, I said, what are you going to do now? I'm here. You know what I mean? Let me in, dude.
Yeah.
And so, but by stroke of good luck, I ended up being there on the same day that two other kids from Cleveland, from Ohio State, missed their flight and then decided they were not even going
to
come.
Oh, that is hilarious. So he had to give you their spot?
So, no. I bartered with alcohol that I had from the youth hostel to convince the other Phi Psi's from Ohio State that they would essentially allow me to be there undercover. And they gave me the packet and the name tag for a kid named Patrick McCardle. And so I became Patrick McCardle for a whole week. And so, like, I answered to Patrick. I introduced myself as Patrick. I went, like, incognito mode as this kid. It was so crazy. But ironically, it gave me the perfect outlet to be somebody else. And, like, I could tell people, yeah, I'm a business major. And I would just see how that landed, you know?
Oh, how weird.
And I could be like, yeah, no, I'm studying music.
Yeah.
Because everyone, it didn't matter what I told them, I was someone else,
yeah.
right? And so, like, through that week, I really found out that, like, I had this, like, burning desire to be an entrepreneur. Like, I just, like, wanted to do business something. I wanted to, like, create and then, like, do something, like, big, you know what I mean? But I had no clue what that was, right?
Yeah.
So I came back with all this, like, loaded passion to tell my parents, like, yes, I'm going to not do pre-med anymore. And it, like, everyone's,
and all,
like,
their hopes and dreams were crushed.
In flames. And so I was also studying theater at the time, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, so they're like, what's your backup plan? So, like, my brain was like, ba-bing, 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 and I was like, I'm gonna be an actor?
Oh, God.
And so my parents were like, what? Like, just, like, everyone
That's
was...
That's your backup
plan? I mean, I was just pulling from nowhere, you know? So, like, I had no clue. I had no clue about the entertainment industry. So after the ashes settled some, I applied to Yale's then production, acting for film and production program.
Okay.
And so I double minored in economics and acting for film. And then I went to Yale for my very last, like, summer. And in that time period, my TA became a really successful YouTuber who then eventually produced a feature film called College Musical, the Movie. The YouTuber's name was, Sam Sui was, like, the main singer, and then Kurt Schneider was the actual music producer. And so I then learned, like, all about, like, this, like, film thing and, like, acting and, like, production. And it was this whole new world. And it felt like I was, like, walking onto a Hollywood set, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was very well funded. We were at Yale University. Like, it was it was just was awesome, right? And so I then started thinking, like, maybe I could do this, maybe something in entertainment, something. And so then, like, I moved to New York. I worked for College Humor for a while. I was, like, a PA. And then I got involved in acting. I started doing, like, acting work for commercials, like, non-union TV shows, like, some modeling stuff, like, commercial stuff. And, like, I really started building sort of a repertoire of, like, what is this whole industry about?
Yeah.
Like, what is this thing that people call entertainment? Like, I did every odd and end job in New York you could possibly imagine. It's a cater waiter. I handed out coupons on the corner. Like,
oh, my God. You were, like, party down.
Yeah, like I like it. Yeah, no, seriously, I did it all. Like, that's, I like, did every crazy, random, oddball, ridiculous job. First job I ever had in New York, I was to report to Times Square, uh-huh, right, and meet up with two other dudes, and then take my pants off, take my shirt off, and hold a sign over my head that said "Men's Warehouse National Suit Drive. Give the suit off your back."
Oh my God!
And I did it with pride.
It's kind of awesome, though.
It was pretty great.
Yeah,
it's
I love
great.
That. I love that.
So that was my very first paying job in New York.
But and you then, probably made like $50.
I did.
Yeah,
I did like a solid $45, yeah. Which then was $10.99. So I got tax on it like out the wazoo. But in that time period, so I was learning a lot about, you know, my strengths, weaknesses, what I like, what I don't like, and mm-hmm. I'd actually had started a business when I was in college, like a t-shirt apparel company. I'd started a tutoring business. I still had that like desire to like start businesses and do something, create something. And then I realized, whoa, like, wait a minute, I could create the thing that I'm trying to audition for. I could do that. And so I started producing some stuff and I thought, wow, this is really cool, but nothing really like fit, you know, because I had this like extensive knowledge and science, mm-hmm. and I just was letting it go to waste. I wasn't doing anything with it. And so post Big Brother, because I was on a reality TV show for like a blink of an eye, yeah. It was like so quick, but it gave me enough like momentum mm-hmm. to then start this web series. And so growing up, right, my father was always the guy, he was the go-to source for information before there was the internet, right? Before there was the internet, it was like, you could ask him anything, right? And dad knew everything. And it wasn't just me. It was my friends, my brother's friends. Everyone knew Victor Juhas was like the source for every odd and end. You could ask him anything. He would know the answer.
I love that.
You could just point in the room. What's that for? And he'd give you like a 2-hour explanation because his wealth of knowledge just was so vast. I mean, he was an entrepreneur. He was a Marine. He was in Vietnam. He was like, He has done so much in his lifetime. He just knows so much. And a perpetual learner, too. Yeah. You know, someone who's just always absorbing knowledge. So he acquired the nickname Wikipedia. And so what happened is we designed this web series to basically mimic just that, but instead apply it to the digital age. And so we then named it Nickipedia because that was the nickname that I started incurring because I was doing the same thing. Like in my adult life, people would come to me as like a resource guide. They're like, dude, like how does this thing do the thing? I'd be like, well, when it was invented and da-da-da-da-da, like this is how. And so I then had this outlet to sort of let that knowledge, you know, then be passed on to the internet.
And so how long ago was that when you first like dropped your very first Wikipedia video?
It must have been about it was almost 2 years ago.
Ooh.
The very first one. Yeah.
And what was the very first one about?
Why is grass green?
That's a good question.
Yeah. So we really wanted to start basic. And
give me some other examples of the kinds of things that you answered.
It's definitely evolved. Uh-huh. Our first couple of ones were very basic questions. Why is grass green? Why is the sky blue?
Why is the sky blue is not as basic as why is the grass green? Well,
it's
maybe
a very
is.
Complicated
answer. It's actually
answer.
Really confusing.
People are like, oh, it reflects off the oceans. I'm like, no, because if that were the case, then it would also reflect off the continents.
Yeah, it would also be green over the grass.
And then I could look up and be like, there's Ohio yeah. and there's Florida, because that's how big the sky is, right? Yeah. So like, that
the
doesn't
sky
make any
is
sense.
Everywhere you go.
Right. It's all over the place. And so some of the other ones that we've had more success with as far as like going like, you know, having a farther reach on mm-hmm. YouTube. One of my favorites actually is Hate the Sound of Chewing. It's this whole episode about misophonia, which is like this real neurological disorder about how people hate the sound of chewing.
I'm going to barf right now with you just talking about it.
And
it's disgusting.
It's
to me.
Great. And I have self-diagnosed that I have misophonia.
I am self-diagnosing myself.
But I am that guy,
yeah.
right? Like, I created this episode because I was like so passionate.
I cannot stand the sound of chewing. I also can't stand it when people have like mouth noise when they talk. And I also,
oh, that's
yeah, so gross. I also cannot I had to edit a video the other day, an interview. I'm not going to say who it was with, but it was a lot of work for us to try to get rid of her disgusting mouth noise. And then the worst for me is when I'm watching a movie and there's like makeout noises. Like they mic the makeout and yeah. It makes me ill. Right. Like it makes me ill.
Yes. So just so you know, people understand what this thing is about, right? There's theories behind weremisophonia, which translates to the hatred of sound.
Okay.
It comes from this idea, this concept that during our evolution, right, from you know something that's like you know that looks like a primate, right? Because we're not truly primates, like in the sense of what we know as like an ape today, right?
We're not monkeys. Yeah,
right?
We're apes. Yeah,
we're apes in that category. So. The idea is, have you ever seen like a hyena around like a carcass, right? It's like freaking out and like trying to wrestle other hyenas and they're all like super aggressive, right? Well, that's the same type of concept, which is like when we are around food and we hear this trigger, which is the sound of mastication, chewing, then we only have two systems in our body really, right? We have fight or flight or we have rest and relaxation.
Yeah.
Two pathways. Apparently, this trigger sound in our brain, like somewhere down deep in our brainstem, says, look, this person is eating. You need to like get on the fight or flight and protect your food and get aggressive.
Or take their food from them.
Or take their food from them. Yeah, exactly. Or just smack it out of their hand. And so then that then turns into this aggressive rage, this anger.
It's disgusting to me. It like makes me recoil. But the funny thing is there are whole cultures. Like Japanese culture, it's like you're supposed to slurp your ramen. Oh. It's like rude not to. And so that secondary kind of social evolution is really interesting to me.
I'm sure there are Japanese kids who have misophonia that are just
just hate it. Like, poor kids.
Yeah, they're like, I'm only eating like peanut butter and jelly from here on out. Like something that makes like no sound at all.
Like in the worst position ever.
No crunch, nothing.
So I love that you have been able to utilize your scientific background to utilize your joy of production and of creation and use this new platform that really allows individuals to be their own boss, to do their own thing, not have to abide by, and don't get me wrong, we still do traditional media,
right.
But not have to fully rely on traditional media. That's what the podcast is for me. That's exactly what it is. It's something where I get to produce it. It's on my schedule. I get to choose my guests. I don't have an executive producer giving me insights that I don't want. I don't have them driving me in a direction because you know just as well as I do, sometimes we do jobs for the money. Sometimes we do jobs for the joy. Sometimes those things do not line up.
Right.
And sometimes we get stuck on jobs that have good things about them that have really bad things that we look past because the good things are what make them worthwhile. The podcast for me, both Talk Nerdy and Skeptic's Guide, is all of the good stuff.
Nice.
And Nikipedia gets to be that for you. So much so that you're now actually, in many ways, spearheading a lot of the web content for Fab Lab. You're really owning that side of our TV show because you can't just have a TV show anymore.
Right. You absolutely can't. Not
especially not for 9 to 14-year-olds.
No,
if you don't have a web component.
Right. In 2016, media is now... It's as if you took an oil-based paint, right, in your hand and you just like smeared it across the canvas, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not just one blob, right? It's not just centralized. It's like across all these different platforms. And so to survive in 2016, you have to understand that any show is really a concept, which is actually a brand. And then you have to then relay that message. And so the web, I think, you know, for a multitude of reasons, I mean, I'm going to be super biased towards the web because my first job was with College Humor and my mentor, my like TA, who's like a phenomenal music producer, was a YouTuber. And so like I kind of in a way like saw his success and like really saw him build his whole career on this whole web thing. And like for me, that became so attractive that it became this whole big part of like my career. And so when you do YouTube videos, you then learn so much about how this whole platform works, right? Mm-hmm. And so now like I'm beyond like the dorky, nerdy guy who like goes to, like every class, like is on every analytic panel. Like I just consume it because it has now become a part of my identity, right?
Yeah.
Like I'm like new media dude. And so like, I just like love it. Like I love everything YouTube and just want to consume as much information as I possibly can because I feel like this type of platform allows people to consume media in a way that is very natural, right? It's like, oh, I want to be entertained. I'm going to, you know, boom, boom, bam, and music. Mm-hmm. Oh, I need to figure out how to fix my computer. Well, that also exists, right?
Yeah.
And so it's like multiverse and much more like how your brain works. And I feel like the reflection of that is very much the success of digital media in general.
Yeah, it's self-paced, whereas traditional media is passive,
right?
You sit and the entertainment comes to you,
right?
Whereas with new media, you get to pace your own entertainment, which is so important. And I think it's really cool that you are contributing to that landscape. And I also have to say on that note that you have an early call time tomorrow.
Yeah,
you're
gonna
do a segment on Dr. Oz. How many of those have you done so far?
This will be my third one for Dr. Oz.
I was saying offline, I'm speaking for me. You don't have to speak because you're a regular guest. I have major issues with Dr. Oz, as everybody knows who listens to my show, because I'm a hardcore skeptic. There's a lot of pseudoscience on the show. I am really glad to see that they are interested in having straightforward, real science. I love that they have you on the show to talk about your Wikipedia videos and to talk about the types of things that their viewers desperately need to hear, not fad diets, not quackery with supplements, but like real science. Do you know what your focus is going to be tomorrow? And this is obviously going to be backdated because we're recording on a Tuesday and this will air next Monday. So
it won't air next Monday?
Our recording will.
I was going to say.
And you're live probably, right?
Dr. Oz is actually pre-taped. So,
well, is it live to tape?
It isn't live to tape.
Oh, so they might actually still be able to catch it, but we don't know when. What are you going to talk about?
Misophonia.
Oh, yes! That's amazing! So you guys just got a primer.
We're talking about misophonia and can you be addicted to ChapStick, which is a video that I did.
That's hilarious. Because people talk about how Carmex is addictive, right? That
it's,
weird.
It's like so crazy. Like people are like, oh, you better not use the ChapStick. You're going to get addicted to it. I'm like,
there's so much weird fault, like ideas.
How do you even, like, what? So like, I was like, I'm going to put this to rest. I'm going to bury this, like, this like nothing concept that's, I don't know where it even came from,
right? I
love
it, but it is folk wisdom. People definitely think it. And they'll literally be like, oh, you know, that brand is okay, but that brand is addictive.
Yes. And so here's the only bit of evidence, right, that has ever said anything close to the addictive nature of ChapStick is this, right? Here's the only solid evidence is that in ChapStick, some ChapSticks have alcohols, right? Like phenol, camphor, or menthol, right? Because they're like, they make it smell good, right?
And they give you that cooly feeling
that
on your
lips.
That
cool flavor. Yeah. That could potentially dry your lips because it's an alcohol, right? But even though it's in a ton of balm, right?
Like, it's like in lanolin.
Right. Yeah. So like, that could potentially dry out your lips.
Which may make you want to use more ChapStick.
Which may then perpetuate the use.
But that's not addiction.
That's not addiction. That's not a physical addiction, right? Because like, there's psychological and there's physical, right? Like, alcohol can create a physical addiction, right? Yeah. Your body then goes in withdrawal. And you shake and you almost have like a fever if you're not like giving yourself alcohol, right? And so that's why alcohol is so addictive, right?
DT is the delirium tremens.
Yeah. And so anyways.
That's not going to happen to you from ChapStick.
Yeah,
you're saying you're not going to get the shakes.
No. But I will say this. I am 100% addicted to ChapStick. And I love it. And I put it on every day and I have it in my pocket.
Yeah.
And like the episodes always start out with like... we do like a little skit, right? Like we don't just do like...
He just grabbed his ChapStick while he was saying that and he's putting it on right now.
Because I just remembered how
you're like,
dry
I
my
have
lips
ChapStick.
Are.
That sounds good.
It's always in my left pocket. And I always got one of my secret little stashes. And I'm sure the people out there listening, I'm sure...
Oh, they know.
They totally...
Right there with you. Yeah.
100%.
I use ChapStick all the time. I have like 3 in my purse. I have 4 in my medicine cabinet. It's... Yeah.
See,
because you got to put it on after you brush your teeth at night before you go to bed.
See, there's a routine here.
Oh, totally.
I need to invest actually into ChapStick companies. Burpees. I'm going for
it. I think you need to make your own.
There we go.
And Wikipedia ChapStick.
Yeah. Yeah. Nick's bees.
Nick's bees. Yeah. Just totally rip them off.
Yeah. Instead of the guy with like the hat and like, it's just my
you.
Face yeah. in a
just
bee.
Looking like trying to look rustic for some reason. Like makes no sense. It's like, yeah, bro. use my rustic Nick speed.
Where else do you get like wax? Like, is there like wax in other like animals like that I can extract wax, their wax?
Like, but there's something called like Canuba wax, right? But I think that probably comes from plants. I'm looking it up right now. We're learning as we go. Canuba wax. Yeah, that's a real thing.
Oh, look at that.
I think you use it on your car, though.
Oh, yeah, that sounds about right.
It's called Carnauba wax.
I just want to know, do wasps make
Brazil
wax?
Brazil wax and palm wax. Oh, they might. Oh, it comes from trees.
Oh.
Yeah, from like the Copernicia prunifera.
I love plant names.
Plant names are so bad.
So insane.
But you can buy a Carnauba wax bar for $5.95 from Penn State Industries. No tax.
Look at that.
Thanks, Google. So anyway, I have to let you go to bed. But before I do it, I close every episode by asking everybody the same two questions.
Oh, sweet.
So, and they're like big deal questions.
Whoa.
I know. So I'm about to.
All right.
Yeah. I'm about to put you on the spot.
I did eat the cookie from the cookie jar.
And I always get such great answers. So I feel like it's really telling. I don't know what it's telling, but it's telling what people say when they answer these questions. So without any more pressure.
Do I get to like answer one first,
yes,
then a pause, and then... Okay.
Totally. But I'll give them both to you.
Okay, cool.
So the first question is sort of the one that's more of a bummer. So I like to ask it first so we can end on a positive note, which is when you think about the future, mm-hmm, in whatever respects you want, whether it's just your own personal path, whether it's big picture global stuff, what is the thing that sort of like keeps you up the most at night, that makes you the most... nervous, the most upset, the most, what do you worry about when it comes to the future? And on the flip side of that, what are you most hopeful and optimistic about?
Yeah, this is good. Mm. This is great. Not many people ask me this question. To answer your first one, mm-hmm, if you look at history, right, humans are like super vicious, right? And like, they kind of go in this cycle, right? Like if you look at like the Holy Roman Empire, right? Like they were like really close to almost having a lot of the technologies that we have today, right? They almost had like, they had steam power almost, you know what I mean? They had metallurgy, like they were really close. And then it sort of disintegrated. Then we went into like the Dark Ages.
And we burned all of the literature.
Yeah, it was like, what?
Yeah.
Like what happened? And so I honestly think sometimes like, regardless of how, you know, like how far we get, are we ultimately going to like recede somehow back into that time? And is all these advancements and all this like tech and amazing things, all these like super far like technological advances that we're making, are they eventually going to perish back into some weird dark age?
Interesting.
Like, is that something that is inevitable? Because the DNA that we have today is no different than, mm-hmm, the same DNA that their Holy Roman Empire had and like everyone else that surrounded them. Like, we're not any different. You know what I mean?
We're still totally warring creatures.
So
we're still very tribal.
Human.
Yeah.
Still so human. And so I think, wow, like, is that, you know, are we going to go back in that cycle again? Because I think, like, what could we do to sort of escape that cycle, right? Like, could we get so far, so like technologically so advanced that we like spread this, you know, like digital seed across the galaxy, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we, you know, have like, you know, all the information stored in like, you know, some super chip or whatever. And then we, you know, we inhabit some other place like Mars, right? And so we're not necessarily attached to like one Earth, right? Yeah. We could potentially like, you know, we colonize other parts of the galaxy.
So basically if we destroy everything on our home planet,
yeah, at least right,
it's like if the Library of Alexandria had like backups.
Right.
And then when it burned, yeah, like there would still be copies in other places,
right,
of all,
yeah,
the texts that we lost.
Right. It's like backup, yeah, to the backup to the,
yeah,
backup. And so then ironically, that's also the same thing that I'm so hopeful about, mm-hmm, right? Is that if we made it this far, right? And like all these advancements happened in like the last 100 years, like, wow, like talk about what a great time to be alive.
Yeah.
Like the breaking edge of all human technological advancement that we know of, right? Like we could technically be like in Star Wars, right? Right? We're like, we're actually in the future and that was way behind. And like somehow they already figured out like lightsabers and, you know, intergalactic travel and like, you know, like space, you know, space travel. Like,
speaking of lightsabers, I have to show you mine before you leave.
All right.
It's behind you in the closet and it's like really badass.
I actually have permanent ones made out of dowel rods. that are in my apartment. I'll show you mine. Okay. I have a Sith one and a Jedi.
I'll show you mine if you show me yours. No, right. Mine's only Sith. Mine's full Sith.
Anyway, so I'm hopeful that the human race,
because
we've done so well so far, that is also potentially our outlet then, you know, to do like evolve one more time.
Yeah.
Right?
So, I like it. Yeah. I like it. I think that I think we're on our way.
Yeah.
I really do. I mean, I know that there's the potential for full destruction, and I know that we are in a position where it could really go either way, but I am endlessly blown away by what individual human beings have managed to accomplish in the last 50, 100, 500, 2,000 years. It's just insane, the rate of improvement and the rate of genius, like utter genius, because of course, with science, the more we discover and the more we know, the more it begets new questions to be answered and new discoveries. And it's just always like, I think it necessitates taking a step back periodically and going like, oh my God, my life is comfortable.
Right.
Oh my God, everything that I have access to is, it's as easy as like going on Amazon and like buying a new router because my internet's not fast enough. You know what I mean? I just buy one that like can handle better speeds. And then all of a sudden I'm like blown away because I have better internet. It's just little stupid things where I don't have to do any of the problem solving. I don't have to know anything about it. Although the more we know, I think the better we can be masters of those kinds of things.
The more we know, the more we know we don't know.
That's also true.
Yeah.
The more you know, Nick.
I do want to add one more thing. Yes. I also want in a 30-mile radius of all big cities, within that radius, I want all cars to be electric for my own selfish purpose that I'm a runner and I don't like exhaust in my lungs.
Well, I'm contributing. I drive electric.
I know, killing the game.
Yep. All right. Well, it is that time. It's time to say goodbye. But before I do, why don't you go ahead and let everybody who's listening know where they can find Nickipedia, where they can hit you up on like Twitter, Facebook. Like, what are the places that you exist on Tay interwebs?
Definitely. So on YouTube, it's youtube.com/NickYuhas. So the name of the channel is Nick Juhas, NickYuhas. That's where the Nickipedia show lives on my Nick Juhas YouTube channel. And then on every social media, it's the same thing. Nick Juhas, @NickJuhas, @NickJuhas.
Nice. That's easy enough. Oh, Snapchat too. You're all over that Snapchat.
I love Snapchatting.
I tried. I did start a Snapchat, guys. I suck at it. I was on a few of Nick's snaps.
Yes, you were.
If you follow Nick, you might see me more often than if you follow me, actually, because when we're on set, he snaps a lot.
I love it because it's like vlogging, but there's no effort, right? There's no editing. It just does it for you.
That's true. Yeah. I just can't ever remember to do it.
Yeah, I know. There's so many platforms.
Instagram. I know. Whatever. That's it's a whole just, other conversation.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah,
but Nick is great at that. If you're on Snapchat, you definitely should follow him. You'll love it. But also Twitter, Facebook, all the good stuff. And Nick, thank you so much for joining me. I guess
I will see
you soon when we do another episode of Fab Lab. Guys, tune in Saturday mornings. Fox, check out Fab Lab on Exploration Station. You'll see the two of us geeking out and being our nerdy selves.
And me broing out.
And Nick broing out. And me going, oh, Nick. Because that's kind of our shtick. All right. Well, thank you so much for being here. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.